south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
I think I mentioned this before, but not in great detail. Latinos, yes, most exclusively young Latinos, are getting targeted left and right on their stupid social media apps. With extortion calls from no good nicks and gang members and such, there'll be a phone call, voice or text message with the proposition, pay me or I'll kill you or your family. That would scare the hell out of you, right? Now, so far, and I know lots and lots of gringos and expats, I've never heard it once happen to any gringo and expat except in Mexico. So on the bright side, at least it's only happening in Mexico. And in the rest of Latin America, only to Latinos stupidly addicted to social media. Thing is, most of those threatening calls are false alarms. It appears that most of those calls are actually phishing expeditions. The callers, who identify themselves as drug cartels or prison gang members, they'll make multiple calls. They have huge lists that they roll through, making multiple calls in the hopes that someone will pay, and some do. In fact, for certain groups of gang members in prisons, that's their job, extorting people by phone. They're in gangs or controlled by gangs, and they have a job to do every day, and that's sort of a call center extortion line. Now, of course, they have to have lists of data. WhatsApp, Instacrap, and Facebook numbers. Regular cell phone numbers and or email addresses, too. And according to Interpol, most all of those phone calls come from prisons through WhatsApp or Telegram, originating in Colombia, Venezuela, and in Mexico. According to Interpol, the scam will go something like this. You'll get a call that'll say, now I'm saying it in English, of course, I've been instructed by so-and-so cartel or gang to kill you or your parents or loved ones. However, there is option number two. Instead, if you pay me $2,000 or whatever, by the way, $2,000 seems to be the common baseline figure. Anyway, the caller will give you a dollar amount and say if you pay it, he'll ignore the order to kill you and your family. And to double down a bit, most times the caller will provide details about your schedule, the house where you live, the school you go to, your room. He'll describe pictures of you having fun at a family get-together or with friends. All of that stuff culled from the internet, photos that you took and posted. Then the caller or texter will provide bank account numbers for you to make a deposit with a deadline, usually 24 to 48 hours, or else, he'll say. Now, when this happens, many times a person will not go to the police. And when they do, by the time the lazy-ass cops get on it, probably a day or two later, past the deadline, they contact the bank. The bank starts investigating. They find out, most often, the bank account's been closed. The money extracted with a debit card from an ATM. And when the account owner actually exists, it's usually a little old lady from a bad neighborhood that gang members roped into opening an account. Now, if you're ever a victim of this kind of scam, and you probably never will be unless you're living in Mexico, and have kids addicted to social media and posting stuff on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. Anyway, according to Interpol, the best way to eliminate the threat is to cancel your social media accounts. Yeah, right, like that's going to happen. For most adolescents and young adults, social media is a huge part of their whole hollow lives. They're always posting stuff, photos, videos, trying to get likes by one-upping their buddies and phantom friends. The way kids and young adults reveal their personal lives is a goldmine for extortionists. By the way, a spokesman for Interpol says, we are not aware of anyone without a social media presence who's ever been threatened. Makes sense. Duh. Another big problem in Latin America is credit card fraud. According to Insight Crime Latin America, a 2022 study of credit card cloning around the world revealed some startling discrepancies in the risks customers face across Latin America in the casual, trusting way they use credit cards. They talk about the ease of availability on the dark web of stolen credit card information. All right, now, in this report carried out by NordVPN, a leading virtual private network company, they found that at present, right now, you can get on the dark web and find about 4 million credit card details for sale. I wonder if you could pay for stolen credit card information with a stolen credit card. I wonder if you could really go dark by using a stolen credit card to buy a stolen credit card to buy another stolen credit card. Try to trace that, why don't you? Anyway, it's reported that about a third of those stolen cards and their information come from stolen and cloned U.S. credit cards, and another third coming from stolen or cloned Latin American credit cards. Now, according to Insight Crime, credit card users in Puerto Rico, Brazil, and Mexico were found to be at the very highest risk of having their details stolen and sold. So why is credit card theft and cloning so prevalent in Latin America? Are the people just stupid or careless? Some of that is true. If you're old enough to remember how credit cards first came into existence in the 70s and 80s in the States, Americans were nonchalant and stupidly trusting too. I remember friends and acquaintances handing their credit card to waiters and bartenders, and they'd disappear in the back room with it for a couple of minutes and bring it back. That was normal. Didn't take long for the bad guys to figure out what to do in that missing time period. The fact is, ubiquitous use of credit cards in Latin America is a pretty new thing. In fact, when I first arrived in Latin America, I met almost no Latino locals who had a credit card, except people who went back and forth to the United States. You know, businessmen, lawyers, professionals, and gringo expats who still lived part of the time up in the States. And the credit cards I'd see way back when were those issued from U.S. banks or international banks. In fact, even now, most people don't have credit cards. They have debit cards. But you knew that already. And crooks and no-goodniks don't much like stealing or cloning debit cards, because they're well aware most people have tiny balances on those things. In Latin America, anyway, the only time they get topped off is once a month or every 15 days when people get paid. Then, and probably only then, for a small period of time, maybe just a day or two, there'll be $300 to $500 in that card. But then bills are paid, shopping is done, and most debit card balances are down to $10 or $15, and they stay that way till next payday. By the way, let me remind you that in Latin America, about 95, even 98% of people get paid either monthly or every quincena. That means every 15 days. I know it seems strange to gringos and expats when they first come down. It seems strange to me, too, but that's the way it is. I remember when I first came down, was just feeling out the place, driving around Costa Rica, Colombia, Panama, Honduras, and every once in a while, I'd see huge lines of people, sometimes a block long, in front of a bank. At first, I thought something's wrong. I thought the worst. After all the Latin American instabilities and the propaganda we hear up in the States, I thought, must be a bank run. Oh no, this is not good. Nobody, I mean no one, wants to see a huge line in front of a bank. Come on, if you ever saw a black long line at an American bank, you'd say, holy crap, what's happening? So anyway, when I saw those lines, it was unsettling till some guy, a bilingual guy, because I spoke no Spanish, said, don't worry, it's just payday. Oh, and way back when, there were hardly any ATM machines at all. Pretty much just in the gringo tourist areas. Then eventually, as ATM machines started popping up all over the place, they call them cajeros automáticos here. Cajeros automáticos. The appearance of those things cut way down on the payday lines at the banks. Though the appearance of ATM machines caused another problem. Because bad guys know when you go into a bank, you might not be taking money out. You might be depositing or paying bills. So unless a bad guy intent on robbing you has a scout in the bank or an inside man, chances are a person walking out won't have any money on him at all. But when you go to an ATM, a cajero automático, every person walking away has some cash dough on him. That's why I don't recommend using lone wolf ATM machines unless they're in a shopping center or attached to a bank. Though sometimes you hear of inside jobs at banks where the teller is passing text info via cell phone to a bad guy accomplice outside, across the street somewhere on a motorcycle. Remember how motorcycle thieves operate? Two on a bike? There have been lots of reported cases where a teller or even the rent-a-cop inside a bank will be in cahoots with some thieves on the street. By the way, over the years, I've had some banker friends, you know, the middle management and executive types, and they tell me when those crooked tellers get caught, 95% of the time they are males. No, not gay, not gender fluid, not LGBT, WTF types. Pure 100% Latino males. And that 5% of women tellers who are doing the dirty deed? They're almost always coerced or forced into it by a bad guy boyfriend. That tells us if you're going to withdraw a lot of dough, go to a female teller. Now, here's the thing. This is interesting. One banker buddy of mine told me, when there's been a robbery like that and it's small time, only $100 or even a couple of $100 has been stolen from someone who just walked out the bank and got jacked a couple of blocks away. Though sometimes a couple of bad boy motorcyclists will follow a guy all the way home or to wherever he's going and jack him in his own neighborhood as he's pulling into his driveway. Hint, hint, you should be practicing situational awareness. Worst thing you could do is go to an ATM, pull out some dough, and get on a bus or public transportation. You've heard me say this before. Every middle-class girl I've ever known has had a cell phone or a wallet or some dough stolen while she was on the bus. Oh, but gringo tourists have to ride that colorful chicken bus at least once, right? Hey, I did it when I first came down years ago. No one ever bothered me, but that's, you know, the place a lot of people get robbed. Anyway, my banker buddy says if a lot of money gets stolen, let's say some businessman withdraws $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000. If he walks out and gets jacked, the cops will show up at the bank pretty quickly, too. A call to the cop shop from you or me, forget about it, but a call from a bank, they're there pretty fast. Here's the thing. If it was an important client that got jacked or a large amount of money, oftentimes they'll have a little meeting announced they're going to give a polygraph to the rent-a-cops and the tellers. But there's a problem with this, he says. When the polygraph is scheduled a day or two later, occasionally one of the tellers or rent-a-cops just won't show up. Sometimes more than one won't show up. They'll have disappeared. Certainly that would be an indication of guilt, right? Not necessarily. Sometimes people won't show up for a polygraph. They'll disappear, quit, or fade away because they've got other things to hide that they think might be revealed in the polygraph. Like what, you might ask? Well, one of the questions on the polygraph might reveal an illicit affair a bank employee is having with someone else at the bank. Or could be an overly nervous bank teller or rent-a-cop has other secrets he's concealed. For example, two very common polygraph questions are, number one, do you drink to excess? Number two, do you take illegal drugs? Those are incriminating questions. If answered incorrectly, will cast suspicion or even get you fired. In general, here in Latin America anyway, average people are terrified of taking a polygraph test. They're terrified of Rottweilers and Dobermans too. File that for future reference. Anyway, even if they've got nothing to hide, sometimes they feel they'll get so nervous, they think that in itself could be incriminating. Funny thing, too, I know a bit about polygraphs because I had to polygraph a couple of workers when some money went missing on a construction job. Even the polygraph administrator told me the average Latin American believes they're spot on, 100% accurate. Fact is, they've seen too many cop and CSI shows. Isn't it funny? It seems the more intelligent a person is, the more highly educated, the less faith he has in polygraphs. After all, if you know anything about human nature and polygraphs at all, you know that a sociopath could fool the machine every time. That's why when accused of malfeasance, a politician will always scream from the rooftops, "I'm innocent. Give me a polygraph. I'll prove it." Of course, anyone with a half a brain knows if one is elected to state or federal government in any capacity whatsoever, you're already dealing with a narcissistic, sociopathic crook. But I digress. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Now, if you recall, like we said much earlier, bad guys like to extort much larger sums, starting with the number $2,000, as in those social media extortion schemes. The thing is, if you're in prison, those social media and WhatsApp extortion scams, in a lot of ways, are faster and more convenient than going on the dark web and buying stolen credit card information. By the way, police and detective agencies have discovered that the second most likely way idiots addicted to social media give up their personal information is by hooking up with bad actors, mostly women, or con men pretending to be women on those dating sites. Think of how easy it is. A bad guy, bad girl, or bad actor signs up on a dating site, puts some very suggestive, hot, sexy pictures up there, and soon enough, there's 100 idiot, slobbering, lonely heart guys dying to make contact. Yep, sexy girls, real or not, can get susceptible men to give up all kinds of personal information. What kind of work they do, how much they make, what kind of car they drive. Of course, a lot of it's exaggeration and outright lies. But still, that info is very valuable to bad guys and extortionists. You get the picture. On a related theme, here's a fun fact. Did you know that Venezuelans, even though their country is an absolute economic disaster, most adults still have credit and debit cards. And even though all the transactions on the street and markets, etc., are done in dollars, not supposed to be legal, but the government looks the other way because it's the only way to get commerce done. Of course, they take funny money dollars in the local funny money bolivar, too. At least I thought they did till one of my Venezuelan friends showed me a video of a guy trying to pay with bolivars at a big shopping center. They demanded dollars. Some places won't even take the national currency anymore. Thing is, though, most adults have credit and debit cards, but those cards can only be denominated in bolivars. All right, now for that fun fact. On October 2021, Venezuela's central bank set a new ceiling for credit cards. And that new ceiling or spending limit is one bolivar or 24 U.S. cents. Nope, that's not a typo. And since the dollar is king there, though officially illegal or at least gray market, that 24 cents or one bolivar will allow users to buy the equivalent of 1 kilogram of ground beef or 1 kilogram of powdered milk. By the way, I want to say this one more time. I'm friends with at least 10 Venezuelans who've escaped their country. Most who were middle class and some who were wealthy and had businesses taken or nationalized by the government, so they got the hell out. And so when we get together and they're hanging around talking about the old country, projecting when the regime will fall and they'll be able to go back there again. They all want to go back. Thing is, though, none of them understands or can believe what's coming out of the U.S. media. That is, coming out of the woke, liberal, so-called progressive media. Though, you have to admit the word progressive has been stained by the wokesters. They call themselves progressive. Yeah, they're progressing right into a state of permanent mental retardation. Anyway, every single Venezuelan I know thinks those idiot woke liberals and progressives that keep saying Maduro, Venezuela's dictator, is being undermined by the U.S. and U.S. allies. But what real Venezuelans who have escaped are saying is that the socialist, progressive U.S. wokesters and commentators are totally wrong when they say that he was a legitimately elected president, not the completely corrupt dictator that he really is. Crazier yet, wokester progressive talking heads say Maduro would have accomplished all of his socialist goals if the U.S. would just stop interfering. And my Venezuelan friends are just astounded when they hear this. They say, none of those wokester progressive so-called American journalists who continuously praise Maduro have ever stepped foot in Venezuela. And if they did, like Oliver Stone did back in the Chavez days, you're only allowed to see what they let you see and only allowed to talk to people they let you talk to, people they've coached. It's the same treatment American dignitaries and diplomats got when they visited the Soviet Union in the Cold War days. The whole thing was theater, completely staged. To make the impression they want to make, they lead you around by the nose. So why am I bringing this up again? I know I spoke about this a couple of times in past shows. Because just a couple of days ago, I was listening to a blowhard, self-described, progressive, woke, liberal podcaster talking about how Chavez and Maduro's utopia has been upset and derailed by American imperialism. My Venezuelan buddies get furious when they hear claptrap like that. They want to drag the guy by the hair, put him on a plane to Caracas, just to watch him get harassed, hassled, and extorted by none other than the government officials at the airport. That's right, you can't even make it out of the airport into the parking lot without bribing a government official. And they're not specifically picking on gringos and expats either. Everyone except vagrants who look like they don't have any dough gets shaken down. Oh, and Venezuelan ladies have become expert in the ways of hiding money and valuables on their person when passing through the airport. They tell me every single government person's on the take. For example, government buildings have huge lines, and in order to get to the front of the line, or even close, you gotta pay a government official. And they do it right out in the open. That's the way it is. It was never like that till Chavez came in. My Venezuelan buddies have told countless examples how government officials have become expert thieves. For example, what normally would take 6 months or a year filing through government lines takes 1 or 2 days if you've got 50 or 100 bucks to grease a bureaucrat. To which my Venezuelan buddies will say sarcastically, it's the U.S. It's their fault. They're the reason why you got to pay off government officials to get anything done. Till Chavez and the corrupt socialists came in, they made all their foreign income on oil. Now it's drugs. Personally, I'm just sick of American media hacks who think they know what's happening in Venezuela and Latin America in general. Yet they never interview the real guy on the street, never talked candidly anyway with him. And the ones that do get boots on the ground, they remain in the tourist areas. They rarely venture out, and if they do, it's with a tour guide. And most of them don't know enough Spanish to be able to do so anyway. So for my Venezuelan buddies, it's pretty disheartening. They always had this idea that the United States was some kind of bastion of freedom, that they had high journalistic standards, that American journalists and talking heads were dedicated to honesty and truth-seeking. Boy, were they wrong. Funny thing, most of the Venezuelan diaspora that I meet in other countries in Latin America, they all had one thing on their mind, to get to the U.S. But as time wears on and they see the wokeism and the creeping socialism that's pervading the U.S., many are having second thoughts about that. They watched socialism and its inherent corruption kill their country, but no woke liberal journalists want to interview them. It's not the correct narrative. All right, moving on. You know, lots of gringos and expats come down, get going on their plan B, throw in the towel, and hightail it back home. Not everyone's cut out for the expat life, you know. Even if you come down here for all the right reasons, sometimes you're drawn back to Cleveland because of family issues, or possibly just because you were such a social butterfly, you miss being engaged with all your friends and relatives. So then, what do you think the expat failure rate is? I'd say maybe 20% of people who came down with a permanent plan B. In other words, they only planned on going back to the States for an emergency or Christmas or holiday thing. And it didn't work out. Now, there are quite a few expat gringos and gringas with a plan B that entails having a foot in the States or Canada and a foot in Latin America. You know, an escape plan. Part-time in the States, part-time in Latin America. Now, when it comes to people who have that kind of plan, they rarely throw in the towel because they consider it the best of both worlds. They can hang with their families and buddies up in the States till they're bored stiff and then come back down the rest of the year for the expat life. Which leaves us with that 20% of expats and gringos who had a permanent plan B who end up going back. Oddly enough, though, when I ask people for the reasons why they want to go back, it's almost never because they ran out of money. Makes sense because it's so much cheaper to live down here than anywhere up in the States. The exceptions being the gringo tourist trail, where prices could be first world all the way, sometimes approaching ridiculous. But you knew that already, right? Anyway, I just came across this new University of Toronto expat study that shows 75%, a healthy majority, of the people who gave up expat life and returned home after a couple of years of trying to stick with it ended up regretting that decision. In other words, about 3/4 of the people who were expats and then turned tail and went back to the States or Canada wish they'd have stuck with their plan B. In fact, the researchers from the University of Toronto study said it was a real surprise for them. They thought those who'd had given overseas life a try and gone back would be satisfied with their decisions, but most were not. The study goes on to say most people gave up on their plan B and moved back to the States or Canada because they missed things about the first world, mostly their friends and family. But almost as soon as they moved back home, they started realizing why they left the first world in the first place. All that stress, aggravation, and anxiety crept back into their lives. The people who regretted their decision said they'd seen how people lived overseas and learned how much more sensible and simple life is, how families stay together and take care of each other, unlike ever disintegrating first world family units. Turns out the former expats who regretted their decisions once back in the land of waste, overconsumption, and excess, practically everything, they became slightly depressed all over again. Even the retired people found themselves on sort of a treadmill again of their own making, which begs the question, how many of the people who returned to the States and Canada returned once again to Latin America because they just didn't give the plan B move enough of a chance? Now, I don't know for sure, but I've done many, many phone call consults, and some of them have been with people stuck in that very circumstance. I remember one couple, an older guy and gal, I'd say mid-70s, they were in pretty good condition though. They were ready and willing to come back all right, but after selling everything they had in Maryland, moving down to Guatemala, getting homesick, selling everything in Guatemala, moving back to Maryland, renting a place, rebuying a house full of furniture, they just didn't think they had the energy to pull it off again. So we ended the phone call with the realization that they had the will, but not the fortitude. An international move at 75 is a pretty big undertaking. So for now, they're up in Maryland, feeling bad about it. They regret not having given it a little more time. They said returning to Maryland was a stupid mistake, which begs the following question. Once you get down here and get that plan B going, certainly you're going to feel like a fish out of water for some time. How long will the doubts last? How much time will it take to know whether you've made the right decision or not? The thing is, you know, it's almost inevitable when you land, you have a kind of a honeymoon period. The air is fresher, it's greener, the light is brighter. Like when you go to a new destination on vacation. And that honeymoon period, of course, it varies. I'd say mine lasted about 3 months. It would have stretched out a lot longer had I known Spanish. And since I was mostly way off the gringo tourist trail where almost no one spoke English, even trying to negotiate things at the supermarket was kind of an adventure. Obviously, there was a certain amount of stress, too. Though you really can't compare what it was like when I first landed down here since there was no internet, cell phones. That means no online translating or internet banking, none of that. I do remember in the early days, after my honeymoon period was over, 6 months or so after I'd landed, I'd be looking over a Central Park from my second-story balcony in a little hotel. I'd say to myself, what am I doing here? My family thinks I'm nuts. Did I make the right move or not? The thing is, I came down here without a complete support system, a very little support system. I knew one crooked lawyer. However, he was my crook. He wouldn't cross me because he was married to a good friend of mine, a British girl. A girl with a heart of gold, whose dad was a gold mining executive. A very proper English family. In fact, her dad once told me at a party, he had watched his son-in-law, the lawyer, in action, and actually refused to give his son-in-law any work at the gold mining company, of which he was the manager. He didn't trust his own new Latino lawyer son-in-law. How about that? Yeah, he was slick, all right. He was one of those guys who wanted to get rich and important way too fast. So anyway, I had this sleazy Latin lawyer friend as my support system, his British wife and her family. So for everything else, I pretty much had to fend for myself. Though I do remember the times in the early days when I'd sit and ponder. Did I do the right thing? Man, I'm just so glad I stuck it out. And those were the days, that first year or two, when I'd call back to the States, you know, a buck or two a minute. My family was not at all on board with my decision to get the hell out of Dodge. Because back then, 30-some years ago, it was a completely different kind of Dodge. There were certainly signs things were fraying around the edges, but nothing like the toxic, woke, Big Brother disaster state we're witnessing today. For my money, the first world, including Europe, became undone with 9/11. By then, I was well established. I'd been down about 8 or 9 years. Anyway, moving to Latin America, the best decision I ever made. Oh, and before I forget, remember, I'm putting together another Expat Insider Seminar. This time it'll be in the DR, the Dominican Republic. It'll be in late October, early November. I'll have the sign-up page ready, I think, in about a week at expatplanb.com. Join me and drink from the fire hose. You'll get to meet my nice little network of like-minded people. We'll hit on everything you need to know to get your Plan B underway. You'll learn about doctors, lawyers, dentists, health insurance, buying, building, renting, dealing with the cops and government. We'll talk about driving, guns, permits, utility hookups, cell phone, internet, and IT services, online shopping like Amazon and eBay, even mating, dating, and romance. So just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, if you want to get on my early bird discount waiting list. This seminar promises to be a little bit different, but we're going to have tons of fun, that's for sure. Stay tuned, more to come. Oh, and one last thing. Some of you might be wondering if it's worth it. Well, you don't have to take my word for it. I guess you could say the most solid proof of all is the fact that at every single seminar I've ever had, except the very first one because it wouldn't qualify, I've had multiple repeat offenders. People who've been at previous seminars and liked it so much they came back once again. In fact, I've had some repeaters come back 2, 3, even 4 times. I rest my case.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos. He knows Spanish.